You're listening to 89.5 KPOO San Francisco, and welcome to Reality Sandwich, a palatable taste of the truth. Every Thursday at noon, we serve up all kinds of insightful information on the various topics of the healthful living model, and you can get past shows of Reality Sandwich at realitysandwichradio.com. My name is Martin Matthews. I'm a certified medical hypnotherapist with Healthful Living, and I'm here today with my co-host,
Julie Matthews. I'm a certified nutrition consultant.
And today's show is just absolutely fascinating, one of our favorite things to speak about, food, and specifically food politics. Who's our guest today, Julie?
Oh, we have a great guest on. Everyone is going to be very fascinated, I think, by this topic. Her name is Michelle Simon, and she has written a book, Appetite for Profit, and she's a public health lawyer who's been working as a nutrition advocate since 1996, specializing in legal strategies and food industry tactics. She's lectured extensively at the University of California Hastings College of Law, where she received her law degree. She's obtained a master's degree in public health from Yale and is the author of the book that I just mentioned, Appetite for Profit, How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back. So that's what I'm really looking forward to today, is that we're going to not only find out all the scary things, but how people can do something about it.
And be an advocate for nutrition, an advocate for good health. Imagine that. We need way more of that in the world. So let's see if we can get Michelle on the line.
Okay. Are you there?
Yeah.
Oh, yay!
Hooray.
Great! So thank you, by the way, for being on the show. We're really looking forward to hearing more about your new book.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So, you know, maybe you can just start with why you wrote this book. I know you've been involved with nutrition advocacy for a long time, and you've probably seen a lot of things, so I'm curious if there's something that started this.
Yes, actually there is. I have been following the issue for a while, but my sort of eureka moment came when I was attending a conference a couple years ago called the Summit on Obesity. And this was an event hosted by Time Magazine and ABC News. And they were bringing together, so they said, 500 of the nation's top experts to forge solutions to the obesity epidemic. And so I went, and giving the keynote address was the former Secretary of Health and Human Services, Tommy Thompson. And he got up there, and he was talking about how all the major food companies were doing such a good job of coming on board and solving the problem, right? He was meeting with the CEOs, and they were helping out. And I thought, that doesn't sound right to me. But sure enough, during the Q&A, a representative from the state of Indiana by the name of Charles Pound got up, and he wanted to know from Tommy Thompson, if Coca-Cola was such a responsible company, then why had they sent 5 lobbyists to his state capitol to kill his bill that would have required only half of all beverages sold through school vending machines to be healthy? Well, Tommy Thompson didn't have a very good answer to that, and he just kind of stammered and said, well, I don't know about that, but if it happens again, you call me, right? And it was at that moment that I realized there was this real dichotomy, this hypocrisy going on, where on the one hand, the major food companies were claiming that they were changing their ways, claiming to be part of the solution. And yet, on the other hand, on the ground and policy arenas all over the country, it was a different story. And I did some more research and found out, lo and behold, this local politician was not the only one finding himself on the receiving end of some heavy-duty lobbying. So that was sort of my first impetus for the book. And then I collected many more examples of that and other types of hypocrisy where the food companies, very much on the defensive, are claiming to change their ways, but it's really just business as usual.
So tell us, I'm assuming they must employ some sort of spin control or some sort of, I'm forgetting the movie, Thank You for Smoking type of behavior. So can you tell us, what are the companies trying to do, or what are they doing?
Right, yeah, and it is important to keep in mind, if the pattern sounds familiar, it should, because a lot of these companies are taking their copying the playbook, if you will, from the tobacco industry. So, for decades, the tobacco industry was in a state of denial about the connection between their products and lung cancer and other health problems. And we're seeing some of similar strategy by certain quarters of the food industry, this idea of, oh, no, there's really no obesity epidemic here, and there's no connection, certainly, between food products and poor health outcomes, and, or for that matter, advertising and health outcomes. So this idea of a plausible denial that comes right out of the tobacco industry is certainly one that we're seeing within the food industry. Not all players are sort of involved in this denial game, but some of them certainly are. Another strategy, which is a little bit more common, is to maybe admit, okay, perhaps there's a little bit of a problem here with the state of public health, but really the solution lies somewhere else. So this is what I call the make excuses, response. So, mm-hmm. And again, taking a page out of the tobacco industry playbook, the idea of personal responsibility comes, in very strong here. So this idea that, well, sure, maybe some people aren't eating right, but it's really their fault. Right, mm. It's all up to the individual to simply change the ways, or it's a matter of choice, individual freedom, all American way. These are the kinds of phrases that we hear from the tobacco industry, and now the food industry is taking this up. This idea is just up to individuals. Never mind, that the food industry spends $36 billion a year telling people to eat the wrong kinds of foods, right? And mm-hmm. certainly nobody in industry spends that kind of money without expecting a good return on their investment. If you think about it, it's rather disingenuous for an industry to spend that kind of money and then blame you when the marketing actually works. So making excuses is another tactic. Mm. And then, of course, the lobbying campaign, which is has been going on for decades at the federal level, but has now shifted over to the state level, where we're seeing more activity, more local politicians really trying to fill the gaping void that's being left at the federal level to address this problem, and yet the food industry is heavily undermining nutrition policy by fighting tooth and nail anything from going forward.
Hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about making better choices, because on one hand, it does make sense that really we are responsible for what we eat, but there's obviously a lot more behind it than simply just that. So why isn't it just simply a matter of making better choices?
Sure. Well, it's not to say that doesn't play a role, and those of us, who work on these issues don't say that people have no responsibility for what they eat. But the problem is that, according to the food industry, individuals bear 100% of the responsibility. And so the question really should be, why is it that it's so hard for people, right? Why is it that the default in our society is to eat unhealthfully and to live unhealthful lives? Why is it that society has been engineered in a way to make the least healthy foods the most affordable, the most accessible, the most convenient, etc.? Why isn't it the opposite? Why shouldn't the default be that the most healthy foods are the cheapest, the most accessible, and easiest? You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So really, when people talk about personal responsibility and individual behavior change, too often that conversation takes place in a complete vacuum, not recognizing that there are many ways that our federal government has put policies into place to make it extremely difficult for people to make healthier choices, right on down, starting with the agricultural policies. I mean, one good example is how we don't even produce in this country enough fruits and vegetables to meet the current U.S. dietary guidelines. So clearly there's some disconnect between what, on one hand, the federal government is telling us Americans should be eating, 7 to 9 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. And yet our agricultural policies, which are largely influenced by, the major corporate players in the agribusiness, has completely disconnected to that public health advice. And so, how can we talk about people making healthier choices if they live in neighborhoods that have been called food deserts, where they don't even have a major supermarket, let alone fresh produce?
Mm.
So there are many ways that society has been engineered, largely due to government practices and certainly corporate influence over those policies, that make it very difficult for people to make better choices.
Wow. Well, let's just talk back up a little bit. I mean, I think a lot of people have seen Super Size Me and understand to some extent that fried foods and McDonald's isn't that great. But I've seen some wonderful things on your website and about McDonald's and some just horrible commercials and things they have. So maybe you can kind of give a background for people that don't even really know what's going on. What is the extent of this industry message?
One thing I think that's important to realize is a lot of people tend to think of the problem around unhealthy eating just being connected to fast food, and of course McDonald's has been sort of the poster child for the problems related to fast food, as depicted in the movie Super Size Me or in the book Fast Food Nation. And that certainly is a problem. And, you know, a lot of neighborhoods may only have fast food even available to them. But really that represents one sector. So the other major sector of the food industry is packaged goods. So all the food that's available through the supermarkets and other retail outlets. So when you think of, you know, the problem with food, it's the restaurant industry and it's the food sold through supermarkets. And, you know, I encourage anyone who doesn't normally shop in, say, like a mainstream supermarket like around here, Safeway or Albertsons, to take a stroll through particularly the center aisles of the supermarket. And you might be quite amazed and disgusted by what you find. I am. And, you know, for example, the cereal aisle. I mean, it's unbelievable the types of products that are being manufactured now, and particularly that are being targeted to kids. So, you know, what passes for cereal is simply no more than candy in a box. And, you know, now what's going on is that the major food companies, because they're on the defensive, are playing this game where they're repackaging their foods. They're pretending, what I call neutral washing after greenwashing, right? They're pretending that the foods have now morphed into healthy products. And one example I write about, you'll see this in the cereal aisle, is General Mills, major manufacturer of children's cereal particularly, has slapped this whole grain label. Remember, the federal government told us that Americans need to be eating more whole grains.
Mm-hmm.
And so food companies, not missing a beat, simply take their highly processed sugary cereals, as General Mills did, and slap the whole grain label on it. So we have the absurd situation now of whole grain Lucky Charms cereal, whole grain Cocoa Puffs, and my personal favorite, whole grain Reese's Puffs cereal. Right? So, and, you know, they get away with this, and people think, oh, well, it's got whole grain now. It must be good for me. And it sounds ridiculous, but, you know, the point is that people fall for this. And so all these ways that food companies, you know, they've already, you know, processed food to death, make these unhealthy products, and now they're taking these same products and dressing them up and trying to make it seem like they're really good for you. So that's a real concern I have about the type of deception that's going on out there.
Mm-hmm.
So, Michelle, this is Martin, Julie's husband here. How do they get away with that? I mean, I've seen a lot of these commercials, and I yell and scream when I see them, and I'm wondering how is it that they get away with it? And I'm thinking particularly the Cheerios commercial that is on that makes an association for the viewers that eating Cheerios will help you somehow lower your cholesterol, when really the small print and the background voice clarifies what the reality is. What they're saying is that if you're eating Cheerios along with a general cholesterol-lowering diet, that your cholesterol will drop. And so the truth is that just Cheerios along with doing all that other stuff is good, but they're selling you the message that Cheerios itself is somehow helping you do
and
this.
It's not even Cheerios. It's just they say a high-fiber diet or something,
yeah,
saying that Cheerios is one.
Exactly. High fiber in your diet helps lower cholesterol. Cheerios can be associated with high fiber, so therefore Cheerios will help you lower your cholesterol. And it's extreme manipulation. It's clearly misleading. How do they get away with these kind of things?
That's a good question. And I mean, basically it comes down to inadequate regulation by the federal government. And there are certain health claims like that that certainly are regulated in some small fashion by the federal government. So any health claim like that that a company makes, say that, you know, eating Cheerios can help lower your cholesterol, has to be backed up, and they have to go through certain hoops to be able to say that. But they get away with, you know, the sort of minimal true effect of eating Cheerios with that disclaimer. So, I mean, it's basically because the Food and Drug Administration that regulates health claims hasn't done a very good job at, you know, really making sure that these claims make a whole lot of scientific sense. And even worse than that, because, I mean, there are, like I said, at least there are some hoops that companies have to jump through to make that kind of a claim, but there are many other types of labels that food companies are using that the Food and Drug Administration is not really regulating at all. So, like this whole grain claim I mentioned, it has no definition. The word natural, you see slapped on all kinds of highly processed products that, you know, bear no resemblance to anything in nature, and yet you know, so the word natural, because it's not regulated, is able to be slapped on all kinds of products. And many other examples of, you know, these types of just words that are used with very little to no regulation. Unfortunately, it's just the federal government being asleep at the wheel.
Wow.
But does the federal government care, I guess, is the big question. And what is their interest and or motivation to intervene in these circumstances to look out for us? If
right.
none of us are really, you know, we're just all consuming it. We're all in effect. And granted, we're all noticing the obesity epidemic and cancer rates and all these other things that are, you know, manifesting as a result of collective ill health. But what's their interest and motivation to intervene?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's a sort of a fundamental philosophical question. You know, what is the purpose of government, and are they actually carrying out their fundamental mission? And really, part of the purpose of government is supposed to be to protect its citizens. And certainly, part of the original vision of government agencies was to protect citizens from, you know, the overreach of corporations that these agencies are assigned to regulating. Unfortunately, we have a situation, though, sort of referred to by some as agency capture, where the very industries that government agencies are supposed to be regulating have basically captured the you know, the process, and to the extent where, you know, we no longer have regulations that truly protect the public's health. Rather, they are, you know, furthering the economic interests of the industries. And part of the problem goes to sort of the, you know, long-standing and separate issue of campaign contribution. So, you know, where we have these industries that give a lot of money away to the key Congress people that serve on the committees that oversee these regulatory agencies, that in turn puts pressure on the agencies to basically do the bidding of industry. And similarly, when you have, you know, administration like we have right now, which obviously is not about to do anything to ruffle the feathers of industry, you're going to have these agencies that, you know, basically go along with what the corporate interests want, and unfortunately the public health suffers as a result.
What are some of the biggest ways that that public health or the individuals suffer? What is it about the messages that are incorrect that are creating, obviously obesity is a big one, but...
Well, one example is how, you know, the federal government is supposed to be in charge of giving the dietary advice, right? There are actual federal dietary guidelines which get revised every 5 years, and it's through this information that gets disseminated to educators, et cetera. And this is a process that has been for decades pretty much, you know, extremely influenced by the food industry, and Mary Nissel in her book Food Politics did a good job of explaining the history of this. And so we have a scientific committee that is supposed to make recommendations to the federal government on how these dietary guidelines should be updated based on actual science. But somehow, even that process, by the way, is politicized, because the members of the committee often have financial ties in one way or another to the various sectors of the food industry. And from, according to one analysis, over half of the committee members back in 2000 had financial ties to the meat, dairy, or egg industry. So right there, we're clearly not getting a good sort of picture of sound science. And then once even those recommendations go through what I call the black box of the federal government, once they come out the other end, they often get even more watered down. So, you know, you'll never hear messages through the federal dietary guidelines to eat less of anything, because mm-hmm. that's going to obviously hurt somebody's bottom line. We get a lot of these twisted messages like eat lean meats and, you know, moderate your amount of sugar, which, of course, has no meaning to anyone. And mm-hmm. so you just get a lot of meaningless messages which don't help people at all. And then in the most recent revision, we also got a new food pyramid, remember that,
mm-hmm.
Where, you know, that icon of nutrition advice nobody really pays much attention to. But the federal government spent to the tune of $2 million given to a PR agency to try and fix the food pyramid to make it, I guess, more accessible to people. And that was, by most accounts, a colossal disaster. And part of the revision of that pictorial was to show a stick figure like it was walking up the stairs to depict exercise. So now we have this tool of federal dietary advice now telling everyone to simply go out and exercise. And while I don't have a problem, of course, with the idea of promoting exercise, but the problem is that the federal government, in doing so, has simply adopted another great excuse and sort of piece of rhetoric coming out of the food industry, which is to say, go ahead and eat as much as you want as long as you, you know, go and exercise it off. Never mind that it takes hours of exercise to you know, burn off the calories in an average package of junk food, whether it's a soda or a bag of potato chips or what have you. So this idea of promoting exercise and individual behavior change right out of the food industry rhetoric has been adopted wholesale by the federal government.
What about, I love some of the, I don't really love them, I find them despicable, but fascinating stories to help people understand what's really going on, is all of the marketing that they do to children. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that somewhat.
Sure. Well, the whole issue of how the food industry targets children, especially young children, has taken on a really key role in this national debate, and rightly so, you know, with rates of childhood obesity increasing and diseases that we only used to see in adults now showing up in children in very disturbing levels. And so people are asking, you know, what's going on? How can we get food companies to stop targeting children? And you know, of course, people then, the answer is, oh, well, it's really all the parents' fault. We hear that sort of the corollary to the personal responsibility excuse is really it's just up to parents to control what their kids are seeing. But, you know, these days it's not simply a matter of turning off the TV. I mean, you can't keep your kids locked up. I mean, kids are being targeted in all forms of what's called new media, you know, through the Internet. Lots of kids are carrying cell phones. There are all kinds of ways that kids are being targeted now behind the parents' back. And another problem, of course, is in schools. I mean, schools have become just this incredible marketing opportunity where companies can target kids in a captive environment. And particularly middle and high schools have become just taken over by the likes of Coke and Pepsi. You see these soda vending machines now lining the hallways of high schools across the country. And so this is another real problem. People are asking, you know, what have we done? How is it that schools have become such targets of these food companies? And so there, you know, the good news is there's, because there's so much attention to this problem, there has been a growing grassroots movement developing, particularly around the school problem, that's made some inroads, certainly in major cities across the country, and to a lesser extent, sort of bubbling up to the state legislature. There's been lots of efforts to pass bills in state legislatures to get healthier beverages and food and so forth into schools. But, like I mentioned earlier, that effort's been largely stymied by the lobbying. So, you know, the question is, how can we get industry to get out of the way to let the policymaking go forward? And then on the, you know, in addition to schools, the problem with regulating, say, the Internet or television or advertising in general, that falls really to the federal government, unfortunately. And just like I was mentioning on the dietary advice side, we have a problem with the federal agency that is in charge of advertising called the Federal Trade Commission, basically taking a complete hands-off approach when it comes to regulating. They certainly could step in and put some reasonable restrictions around marketing, say limiting the ages that companies can target kids and so forth, which other countries have done. Mm-hmm. By the way, the UK is poised to put some restrictions around targeting kids under the age of 16, saying that junk food ads cannot be targeted to kids under 16, a very bold approach. The U.S. is certainly not anywhere near taking those kinds of strides. So, you know, again, we have a problem where the federal government just simply is not willing to be a leader on this issue. And while the efforts going on at the school level, like I said, are making some headway, it's still tough to have any broader policy measures put in place at the federal or state level.
For people that are just tuning in, you are listening to KPOO San Francisco, 89.5 FM. This is Reality Sandwich. I'm Julie Matthews. I have my co-host, Martin Matthews, and we are speaking with Michelle Simon about her book, Appetite for Profit. So, Michelle, I just want to talk a little bit about the ad I saw in China, because I find it so interesting because it's, you know, I haven't really watched TV in a long time and haven't really seen ads, and it's a totally different culture. So to see this ad that you had sent out to everybody really showed me the lengths that they're going to try to associate whatever it is, sexiness in this case, with a burger. Right. So maybe, I don't know if you can describe it a little or talk about what's going on over there.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, the generalized problem is that the major food industry players in the U.S., as they saturate the market here, are looking for their markets. And it's just, this has been going on for some years now. Obviously, McDonald's has already infiltrated pretty much every part of the world. But now we're seeing it particularly on the increase in developing countries, which makes it especially disturbing. So these countries that are just sort of, you know, getting their feet on the ground economically, part of their progress, quote-unquote, is to, you know, be going to McDonald's and those sorts of places. And in China, it's actually, unlike here, where, you know, it's thought that eating at McDonald's is sort of a lowbrow thing to do, but in China, it actually represents a measure of success. So that creates just a whole other kind of level of difficulty and disturbing reality. But the commercial you're referring to showed basically a couple practically having orgasms over eating a McDonald's hamburger, some such thing. It was hard to really tease out because the graphics were very involved. But the point is, as you say, they're associating sex with eating at McDonald's. And I don't know that it's something we would really see over here. I mean, it's often the case that commercials that will fly in other countries sort of actually, I mean, we do have as bad taste as we have in this country, there seems to be sort of less of a willingness to cross certain lines here than in other countries. But, yeah, I think it just goes to the general exploitation of other cultures and, you know, trying to get other cultures to change the way they eat. I read an interesting article about General Mills, again, the cereal company, going into China and how they were having challenges because, of course, the Chinese do not eat cereal for breakfast, and they certainly do not eat milk, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this
right.
Most cultures, in fact, across the globe, do not eat dairy products, and the Chinese being one of them. So this was a challenge that General Mills was finding out, you know, how can we get the Chinese to eat cold cereal and cold milk because, by golly, you know, we need this Chinese market because it's, you know, a billion people. So that's the sort of thing that's going on with American companies exporting our way of eating at the same time exporting our health problems. So now we're seeing childhood obesity becoming rampant in China. India, another country that has been thoroughly innovated and continues to be at a rapid clip by American food and beverage companies, to the point where India finds itself with the dubious distinction of having the top rate of diabetes in the world.
Wow.
So this is obviously a looming public health crisis globally now. And not to put all of the blame on American food companies, but certainly we have to be looking at, you know, how rapidly these countries are shifting from their traditional diets, which, of course, is largely healthy, you know, plant-based foods, whole foods, you know, foods that look like they come from nature, and then switching over to this highly processed, very meat-centered diet, which obviously hasn't done this country a damn bit of good.
Well, and it's natural for humans to want to be healthy and to be eating things that make them healthy, yet here we are, clearly, in a very unhealthy state collectively in our country. And these companies and these industries, as you outline in Appetite for Profit, clearly are feeding off of us and feeding off of our ignorance and perpetuating it, getting it into our heads and into our patterns at a very young age. We've allowed them into our schools. The government has allowed that. We've allowed it. What will people learn, and how will they be empowered by picking up your book? And in addition to that, what are you doing for us out there to help address all this?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting to address what you just mentioned about, you know, people often don't understand why is it that, like, the junk food tastes so good, you know? And what the food industry has done very cleverly is really exploited the human being's natural inclination for certain flavors. So, you know, when we evolved in the wild, we developed these tastes of flavor for fat, sugar, and salt, because because when those foods used to be scarce in our environment, and so we needed to get as many calories as we could when we found food. And so we're basically hardwired to prepare for famine. And of course, now that protection has been turned on its head by the food industry, which exploits our natural inclination for these flavors, and then people are loading up on them, of course, incessantly because they're so ubiquitous in our food supply. So that's just sort of an explanation for why, you know, we tend to like these heavily, intensely flavored foods, but we're not meant to be eating them constantly. So to get to your actual question, what can be done about it? Well, you know, I didn't want to just give the gloom and doom in the book. You know, I wanted to make sure that people realized that there was a lot that can be done. And I feel like, you know, the first step, this is certainly what I try to do, is to try to understand the context for the debate. So, you know, when you see a food company come out with some big announcement, or you see the latest fangled product, which, you know, is labeled as good for you, to really have a healthy dose of skepticism when you see this. And the important thing, of course, is to realize that food companies do not have your best interests at heart. I mean, it seems rather obvious, but they actually try to convince you that they do, that they care about you, that they want you to eat healthfully and all this kind of nonsense. And to realize that a food company's first and foremost interest is to its own bottom line, and there's simply no getting around that. So no matter what the food companies say or do, no matter how much money they might give to the local Boys and Girls Club, they're always going to be, you know, making money selling unhealthy products. That's just the name of the game. So it's basically not trust food companies when you see their claims, when you see, you know, that they're hooking up with the local, you know, philanthropic organization, et cetera. So that's number one, to understand what's going on, that their goal is to keep making money and to deflect any criticism, to deflect government intervention in their business practices. So I just think it's really important people to understand that and to really be critical when you hear any claims coming out of the major food companies. And then beyond that, I give a number of resources in the book for people who want to get a little more involved. And there are many wonderful projects going on all over the country. I already mentioned the grassroots movement to improve school food. So certainly, you know, if that's something of interest in the Bay Area, there's certainly many opportunities to get involved with improving school food. And then, of course, communities are something that we really can't forget. There's been so much focus on schools, and rightly so, but I think it's also critical to realize that, you know, getting fresh produce into poor neighborhoods, especially where it's so desperately needed, is really critical. And that even in the Bay Area, where we think, you know, we are so sort of ahead of the game, and we are in a lot of ways, there are still many, many people who live in neighborhoods that are, you know, desperate for fresh produce. And so that really is a wonderful way to get involved. And there's a whole movement of alternative sustainable agriculture out there that is, to me, the most exciting and, you know, really gives us the most hope for actual change. And so I give lots of resources in the book, various organizations people can get involved with all over the country, and in addition, specific examples of policies that can be put into place and tips on how to get those policies passed.
That's great. For people that are also here locally, Martin was just reminding me, we have a local nonprofit organization called Nourishing Our Children, and we go around to schools and teach parents about what really healthy food is and quality food and all of that. So if anybody's interested, you can find more about that at you could find it at healthfulliving.org, our website, but you can also go to directly to nourishingourchildren.org. So I had another question. It's sort of going back a little bit to the gloom and doom, so I'm going backwards a little here. But, you know, there's something very fascinating that you're talking about in your book in terms of food companies attempting to co-opt health groups and things, and this is fairly disturbing. So you were talking about having a healthy dose of skepticism earlier. So, you know, when you go to the American Diabetes Association, you expect the most sound advice possible. And so tell us what is going on or what the food industries are trying to do.
Right. So part of the strategy is to sort of co-opt the scientific process and in particular to buy up various health professionals in the field to kind of get them over on the food company side so that they're not speaking out, saying any bad things about them. And this strategy plays out in a number of ways. And one of the ways is to put various health professionals on what this company is called their health advisory board. So my favorite example of this is Dr. Dean Ornish, who actually is right here in the Bay Area, and someone who's well known for his pioneering work showing how a vegetarian diet can help not only prevent but actually reverse heart disease. Well, he now serves on the health advisory boards for McDonald's, ConAgra, and PepsiCo. And this is, great news for these companies because obviously they get this well-known medical doctor to basically say that they're A-okay. And if you go on the McDonald's website, you'll find a page dedicated to Dean Ornish. And I just think this is rather unfortunate because it really sends the wrong message. It says that what these companies are doing is a good thing, and it gives, this sort of endorsement by these sorts of health professionals. So that's one strategy. Another one is to give lots of money to various health groups. So one you mentioned was the American Diabetes Association, which I was shocked to learn during the research, while I was in the middle of researching this book, the American Diabetes Association formed a partnership with Cadbury Schweppes. So this is the third largest beverage company in the world and, of course, also a candy company. So you've got candy hooking up with soda, giving money to the American Diabetes Association.
Yeah, that can't be good.
You wouldn't think so. So, it would be funny if it weren't so sad and disturbing, but I do have this sort of hilarious exchange in the book between the medical director of the American Diabetes Association and this reporter who I put on the story, who was trying to get to the bottom of this, where he basically, this ADA guy says, oh, well, we don't see a problem with it. I mean, we have to get our money from somewhere. And anyway, sugar doesn't really cause diabetes. So, it's quite mind-boggling to realize, that these groups that are obviously supposed to be working on preventing these problems, addressing these problems, are basically taking money from the very industries that are causing the problems. And so, when people ask me, well, who can we turn to get information? I have to say it's a rather tough question to answer because, obviously you can't go to the food companies themselves. They don't have your interests at heart. The government, certainly the federal government, is increasingly in the pockets of the food industry. And now we have even the major health groups, who you would think would be the ones to turn to, also now often in bed with the food industry. So really there are very few sort of established groups out there that don't take money, aren't compromised in some way, and they're, I do talk about the good guys in the book, and I have a list of them in the appendix, but, it is rather disheartening to see this sort of co-optation going on.
So did the diabetes representative say anything about what he thought did cause diabetes since sugar wasn't involved?
He says it's just calories, any calories. I mean, it seems to sidestep the fact that sugar is obviously has more calories.
Wow.
Well, we allow
broccoli has calories. Brown rice has calories. That's really crazy.
Yeah.
Well, they're allowed to get away with saying these things because in isolation, you could say sugar does not cause diabetes and cigarettes do not cause cancer. However, that's not the reality of the situation. The reality of the situation is people are engaging with those substances habitually over long periods of time or short periods of time, whatever it is, that thus has a direct correlation to manifesting in those circumstances. But they don't have to own that. And back to the earlier point about we can't trust the food companies to look out for us. We certainly can't trust the government to be looking out for us and doing their job. We're left only with our own common sense, which itself has been severely co-opted by all these different entities telling us that we can't even trust ourselves. But when we see something like, organic macaroni and cheese, it's got to be a flag of our own common sense indicator to stop and really question that. And somehow we gain our own ability to look after ourselves and to put ourselves first.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're right. It does come down often to just using our own common sense. But, the problem is, of course, so much of the information that's out there that we might want to base common sense on, or those of us that, may not have the wherewithal or time to be, sifting through all the noise, really are influenced by the messages that we receive. Studies have been done to show that the the number one place that people get their nutrition information from is advertising. I mean, and it's really no wonder, right, because that's what they're bombarded with every day. And obviously that's not the best source of information. And then, you know, if you think about, well, what would another source be? Well, perhaps federal government messages around nutrition. Well, again, you know, those aren't so good either. So when it comes to actual, you know, decent information, it's the alternative sources like your own, and it's, you know, books like mine. But these aren't the forms of media, unfortunately, that the majority of people are exposed to and getting their information from. So it's rather challenging, I think, for the average person to get good information and to change their ways. And then even with the information, again, we have a problem of access. So it's both components. It's information and access that are so critical. And those things really have to be changed through policy.
Mm. Absolutely. You were talking about some of the examples and with the Dean Ornish and his own webpage and all of that. And, you know, that brings me to the question of all of these fast food companies attempting to make healthy foods. They have this McDonald's salads, and they often kind of aim it at young girls in their 20s and put funny little having a bad hair day kind of ridiculous marketing things along with it. I guess first question is, some people would say that a salad is a step in the right direction. And so is it, or what is really behind those foods? And is there any safe option, or in my guess is going to be better to not patron the stores and give them any money, even if they have something semi-healthy. But I want your opinion.
Sure, yeah, I do a complete analysis of the McDonald's salad and the whole step in the right direction argument. And there's a couple ways to answer that. One is that, particularly if you look at, you know, what McDonald's calls salad, for the most part, they're, you know, just calling something a salad does not make it healthy. Okay, so, you know, in several of their so-called salads, they have more of calories and fat than a Big Mac. So, you know, if you load up a salad with fried chicken and bacon and creamy dressing, obviously you're going to have some health problems there. So that's number one. I mean, the whole salad, you know, it's rather deceptive. And then the truth is that from an economic standpoint, McDonald's makes way more money selling cheeseburgers and fries than they do on salads. So, you know, it's simply just a drop in the bucket compared to their overall sales. And, you know, there's a lot of proof and evidence that people simply don't go to fast food places to eat a salad. That's not why people are going there. Mm-hmm. So the fact that it's available, even if, let's say you can find one that's relatively healthy, and you probably can in a lot of these places these days, but the truth is that's so minor in comparison to the overall types of food that these companies are selling. So in other words, the public health impact on a massive scale is extremely minute. Mm. In addition, there are problems with, you know, just relying on a company like McDonald's to be making so-called healthier food when clearly it's not just a matter of the, you know, nutrition facts for that particular item. There are many, many other factors that go into McDonald's sort of operating, you know, behavior that are problematic, you know, many of which are chronicled well in Fast Food Nation. So, you know, to me, there are so many reasons not to eat at McDonald's, you know, whether you care about labor practices or the environment or, you know, just urban blight. I mean, you know, just so many reasons to not shop at a place like McDonald's, that whether or not they happen to have a salad on the menu, to me, is rather besides the point.
I tend to agree with you on that one.
Since we are naming names in the last few minutes here, who are some of the other outrageously egregious offenders of the public good?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because there's two that we haven't really talked about. One is, and again, on the packaged food side, PepsiCo and Kraft Food, those are the two others I want to mention, are both engaging in a similar deceptive marketing strategy, and that is to create these self-defined seal programs. So for PepsiCo, which, by the way, owns not just the Pepsi-Cola products, but Frito-Lay, largest food menu, snack food maker in the country. So now on many PepsiCo products, you will see what they call the smart spot symbol. And this is this green and white label slapped on such healthy products as Diet Pepsi, Gatorade, baked Cheetos, and other baked, you know, unhealthy, extremely highly processed products. But PepsiCo has decided, based on its own nutrition standards, that these products are now deserving of this little self-defined checkmark green and white symbol. So that's one company. And then Kraft Foods, again, doing a very similar thing with another green and white symbol, because everyone knows green means healthy. So you slap this little green label on, and for Kraft, they call it the sensible solution, right? Because what could be more sensible than continuing to eat Kraft's crappy products? And this, of course, Kraft is a company that manufactures every other food product in the supermarket, second largest company in the country. And so if you look at, and particularly around marketing to kids, Kraft Foods has taken on, has taken a lot of heat because they manufacture and market so many products that are aimed towards kids. And so Kraft came out with this big announcement back in 2005 saying they were going to change the way they market to kids. Well, one of the ways they're changing is to slap these labels on some of their Lunchables varieties.
Ugh.
They own those awful Lunchables products. And so now you'll see this sensible solution flag showing up on such wonderful Lunchables varieties, like my favorite pepperoni-flavored pizza. Pepperoni-flavored sausage. I don't know. Somehow they combine pepperoni and sausage. It's just so disgusting. I can't even. But this is part of the deception to keep mothers, to, you know, thinking that the food's good for you, for their kids. Kraft Foods also owns Post Cereal, which makes Fruity Pebbles line. And so now you'll pick up a box of Fruity Pebbles, which, again, has the Sensible Solutions flag. And because they've added some polydextrose, which is a fake form of fiber, you know, made up in the laboratory. So they throw this in, and they say it's a sensible solution. So Kraft Foods is actually one of my along with McDonald's, my poster child on the packaged food side for completely deceptive labeling and claiming to be changing their ways when it's really just business as usual.
Wow.
So they educate the public as far as what's sensible for them,
right,
compared to their own standards. I can't imagine what their own standards must be. We're coming down to the last moment or so of the show, and I do want to have listeners hear where they can go to learn more about what you're doing and, of course, learn more about Appetite for Profit. But just the last thing that I wanted to share is this whole notion began for me when I was in seventh grade, when I learned what the USRDA standards really were about. And the nutshell of my report that I did back then was that those standards were put in place as the levels of nutrients and the stuff that we should have to prevent our body's shutting down, the absolute minimum necessary to sustain life.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that's what they're touting to everybody? I am clearly on my own if I want to be healthy. And we see that now, 30 years later, we're getting our information from companies telling us what's healthy and slapping a label on it, and people are being just blindly misled. And it's time for each of us to do whatever the heck we can to wake up and reclaim our own right to health and happiness. And it starts with the individual and permeates out to having broader impact on policy and these organizations and doing what we can to not allow it to continue with our, at least with our own behavior and thoughts and actions. So where can folks go to read more about the book and to hear more about you?
Sure. So I totally agree with that. And I think you said it well, to start with ourselves and then go out from there to try to change policy. And so my website is informedeating.org, all one word, informedeating.org, and there's obviously information up there, about the book. And I do maintain a mailing list, people who want to stay on top of the news and so forth. So that's the place to go.
And it's a great mailing list. I'm on it, and that's how I found the China television commercial that you had sent out. So I encourage everybody. Good information.
Thank you.
Thank you for being on.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, well, you've been listening to Reality Sandwich. You can get this show and all of our past shows available for free download at our website, realitysandwichradio.com. And you can find out more about myself, Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant, and
I'm Martin Matthews, certified medical hypnotherapist. You can learn more about Julie and I at healthfulliving.org. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next Thursday at noon, and just reminding you that all positive change begins with you. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Reality Sandwich on 89.5 KPOO, San Francisco. This show and any past shows of Reality Sandwich are available for free download at realitysandwichradio.com, where you can also read about upcoming shows. To learn more about Julie Matthews or Martin Matthews, go to healthfulliving.org. Thanks for listening.